Get started. I'm David Grusky, and I want to welcome you to, I guess, sadly, the last in our quarter-long series of debates about how poverty and inequality are generated and what, if anything, we might do to reduce poverty and inequality. The debate series is co-sponsored by the Stanford Center on Ethics and the Elfinworks Foundation, and is hosted by the Stanford Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, a program within the Institute for the Research in the Social Sciences. We'll be focusing today on philanthropy and the role that it should and does play in reducing poverty and inequality. In many ways, one of the fundamental features of American exceptionalism is this putative reliance on philanthropy as an inequality-reducing strategy, a situation in which, again, the United States shifts over into the non-governmental sector what elsewhere is very much the province of the government. And so the question that then emerges is whether this narrative about the role of philanthropy is on the mark. Is it indeed reducing inequality? And more importantly for this debate, should we understand the main function of philanthropy being that of reducing the amount of inequality in this country? We're fortunate to have with us here today Kenneth Pruitt, Carnegie Professor of Public Affairs at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He has, I should stress though, taught everywhere. He's taught here. He's taught at the University of Chicago. He was dean of the graduate faculty at the New School. He's also played every administrative role imaginable. He directed the United States Census Bureau, just a little baby job. He directed the National Opinion Research Center. He was president of the Social Science Research Council, and on and on. And then while all this administrative work was going on, he's been extraordinarily influential in terms of his research, including, for example, a current project on the history of official racial classification schemes in the United States from the late 18th century to the present day. We're also very fortunate to have with us here today Rob Riche. While Ken Pruitt has been everywhere, Rob Riche is a Stanford man. He's a loyalist. He got his degree here at Stanford and then was immediately snapped up by the university and has moved quickly through the ranks and is now associate professor of political science. He's working on two main projects, one on philanthropy and inequality that we'll learn a bit about today, and then another on the ideals of equality and adequacy as they play out in educational policy and reform. And I should say he's not just superstar scholar, but also superstar teacher. He's won Stanford's highest teaching award, the Walter Gores Award. So it's a real honor to have both of them with us here today. Here's the format, the standard one. We're going to lead off with Rob Riche, going to give a 20-minute or so statement laying out his position, followed by an equivalent statement by Ken Pruitt. And then each of them will have 5-minute rebuttals, and we'll open up to the floor. So welcome.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, David, for having me and for inviting for Ken to join us. Not sure how the date got screwed up there. It's not really May, March 4th. I want to spend just a bunch of time laying out some facts about how little philanthropy and charity actually gets to the poor, how small the redistributive element of American charity and philanthropy is. It was a surprise to me to find this out. And then end up with a question about should that matter at all? And I'll answer that it should. I'll just begin by noting that the events in the newspaper these days reaffirm for us what I think the common sort of on the street notion or interpretation of what charity is about. Natural disaster strikes and individuals through their own voluntary sense of what they ought to do in such cases give money away or volunteer their time or help in order to relieve the distress of those in need, whether it's an earthquake, a cyclone, a tsunami, or even a terrorist disaster. This is supposed to be what's distinctive about charity in the United States and even elsewhere, and something that's celebrated widely when people voluntarily give up their own money or time to help others. I want to give a short answer to the question posed first. Does philanthropy shortchange the poor? The quick answer is an unambiguous yes. This is an article that appeared in the Chronicle of Philanthropy at the end of December, talking about the growing trends in the U.S. charitable sector or philanthropic sector, where money gets allocated. Growing divide. As charities enter the final stretch of the busy year-end giving season, the divide between wealthy organizations and other nonprofit organizations is growing more stark. Even as many wealthy nonprofit institutions, we sit in one of them, like museums and universities, are reporting record increases in contributions, other charities, especially those that provide direct services to the poor, are struggling to get donations and keep up with rapidly escalating demands for aid. This is the interesting last sentence. Some veteran leaders of organizations that serve the needy say they have not faced such a tough time before in their nonprofit careers. At the very moment when massive and large donations regularly make the news headlines about people giving literally millions of dollars to nonprofit organizations, it's the same time when those organizations that serve the poor are facing the most difficult fundraising challenges ever. All right. So the outline of what I want to go through in roughly 15 minutes: where are charitable dollars from? Where do charitable dollars go? And should we care in particular about that distribution question? All right, let's start with something that was also a surprise to me: where charitable dollars are from. If you think about where charitable dollars are from, just by your intuitive sense, reading the newspaper, thinking about what gets reported about charity and claims in the U.S., I wouldn't criticize you if you would predict that one of the main sources of charity or philanthropy in the United States were foundations, like the Gates Foundation, like the Clinton Foundation, like Ford or Rockefeller Foundations. These large, honored institutions in American society, which regularly give away large sums of money, sometimes in the interests of the poor or to help the needy, but other times for other things. But nevertheless, these foundations, something that is sort of distinctively American, claim a lot of the news attention or media attention for American philanthropy and charity. However, if you look at the data about where charitable dollars are from, you'll find that foundations account for a shockingly small component of American philanthropy. Here's the chart. There are four sources of American charity: living individuals, who account for 3/4 of all charity in the U.S., people who give money away at their death, corporations in their foundations, and then regular foundations like the Gates Foundation. Only 11.5% of the charitable sector. So when you read, for instance, that Warren Buffett gives $30 billion to the Gates Foundation, a huge sum of money, making the assets of the Gates Foundation truly astonishing. Individuals gave away, this is actually sources from 2005, if you looked at 2006 data, it would be roughly $240 billion. Individuals gave away $240 billion. If you care about American charity and philanthropy, you have to pay some attention to foundations, but all the real action is in individual giving, 3/4 of the pie. All right, well, where do those charitable dollars go? Let's take a look at where all charitable dollars go. This is data from 2005. If you updated this, it would be nearly $300 billion. Again, the astonishing thing for me when I first discovered this, charitable dollars go overwhelmingly to one main source: religion, religious organizations, and religious organizations that are faith-based charities performing social services, say like the Salvation Army, have been sectioned off into their appropriate category over here of human services, or of Catholic schools, or of a religiously-based healthcare organization. So when 36% of charitable dollars go to churches, that means the Sunday basket at church, or a contribution to the synagogue, or a contribution to the mosque, to pay the pastor, to keep the lights on, turn the heat on. It's the operating budget of the religious organization. An interesting thing to me that I find this interesting, when you read scholars who write about the nonprofit sector and the distribution of dollars, very often within the first paragraph or two of a scholarly article, you'll find something like the following. A footnote down at the bottom of the page that says, for purposes of this analysis, we have omitted giving to religion. Which is to say, you've omitted the main recipients of American charity. Now, this picture, this pie chart about where the dollars go, actually gives you an optimistic picture if you were concerned about distribution, because this is from all four sources, from corporations, from individuals, from foundations, and from bequests. If you only focus on where it is that living individuals give their money, so just take the $240 billion or so that living individuals gave away last year, where do they give their money? More than half of every charitable dollar goes to a church. Now, perhaps some of you are thinking, oh, but the operating budgets of churches perform some important social services. They care for the needy. They run some social service programs. The best available data on what percent of a church budget goes for social services to help the needy is in the single digits, about 5% of a church budget. Very low. So what do we get from American charity? We get support for religion, first and foremost. And not for the social services that religious organizations provide. The Salvation Army does a really fine job at doing that sort of thing. But that's not counted here. That's counted in the relevant category of human services or social welfare. Roughly 10% of American charity. Some of you in the room may be wondering, well, how about giving overseas, where the needs are potentially even greater? That doesn't even make the pie graph because the percentage is so small. It's about 2% of American charity. Let me give you a different way to illustrate this, and also a sort of breakdown about different kinds of givers. This is a visual graphic I pulled from an article that recently appeared in the Stanford Social Innovation Review that shows the division of how a dollar goes, a charitable dollar. You're basically seeing the same thing as I showed you before from individuals. 61% goes to religion, basic needs 10%, international 1%. The bottom table is what I want you to pay a little bit of attention to. The percentage of giving by those who are very wealthy, those who have incomes of over $1 million, where do they give their money? They don't give it by and large to churches. You might be thinking, oh, good, maybe they're giving their money away to those who are in need. No, they're giving their money away to healthcare organizations and universities. Well, maybe they're funding a chair for a university, or maybe they're funding financial aid. Maybe they're funding the emergency room to help people who need healthcare that wouldn't otherwise get it. There, the data gets a little bit murky. But the overall consensus, so far as I can distill it, is that the vast majority of charitable philanthropic gifts in this category are not going towards organizations who try to meet the needs of the needy in the present day. If you took a long-term time horizon, you might get a slightly more optimistic story, but I think you'd be pushing it. So we have a rather grim picture. Let me conclude this section simply by saying, I don't think there's any way to contest the simple fact that American charity does not do much at all to help the poor. It does virtually nothing. So, should we care about that? Well, if you began where David Gruske began by saying, perhaps the distinctive American compact is we shrink the size of the state because we think the slack is being picked up by American charity, you have a picture here which tells you otherwise. I think we should care that so little American charity goes to help the poor and the needy. It's a problem. Let me give you a few reasons why. First of all, America is distinct, is unique in how inclusive the 501c3 sector is. The package of organizations which are classified as nonprofit organizations eligible to receive tax-deductible contributions. An unbelievable array of organizations get counted within that sector. Baldness Research and Puppet Theaters, soup kitchens and free health clinics. You go through an enormous list of organizations, and they all receive uniform treatment from the state. Every single one gets the same tax deduction for their donors, no matter what kind of activity they're engaged in. You give $100,000 to a puppet theater, from the state's perspective, that is as worthy as giving $100,000 to a soup kitchen. You get the same tax rate. That's a peculiar thing about American philanthropy. Next, I want to suggest to you that there are some categories of giving, in particular private giving to public schools, where American charity is not merely indifferent to redistribution or equality, it is actively worsening inequality. This is a local picture, for those of you who are from the area, of things that are called school foundations set up to raise private dollars, philanthropic dollars, to supplement the public school budgets. Because Sacramento, California citizens have decided not to fund their public schools all that well. So these school foundations arrive. This is from the year, I believe, 2003, 2004, of the top 15, is it 15, 20, whatever it is, school foundations in California by the amount of money they raised and what district they're in. You'll see that the Irvine Public Schools Foundation and the Inner City Education Foundation, et cetera, Los Angeles County Education Foundation, were raising millions of dollars privately through charity to supplement public funds for schooling. You might begin to think this is a welcome picture. Poor schools are getting charitable dollars. In fact, the poorest districts rank pretty high on the top recipients of these philanthropic contributions. What I want to do now is show you what happens to those philanthropic contributions if you divide the donations by the number of pupils in each district. On a revenue per pupil basis, look what happens to the top performers. Urban Education Fellowship, Los Angeles County Education Program, $4 a kid, $6 a kid. Let's look here at, I'll highlight this for you, the ones that are shaded are small suburban school districts. Let's take one close to us. Woodside Elementary School. Woodside School Foundation raised nearly $2.5 million for their public schools, for a public school with about 400 kids, nearly $6,000 a kid, in addition to the public funds, with tax subsidies from the federal government. The American government is actively abetting the worsening of inequalities in public school expenditures in California, given the distribution of American charitable dollars there. Not merely indifferent to equality, it's actively worsening it in this case. All right, let me wind up by giving you two more general arguments. I do believe that redistribution matters. I do believe that American charity and philanthropy ought to do more to help the needy, to help the poor. Let me give you two reasons. The first is that as a result of the tax deductions that are available to donors when they make their charitable contributions, the U.S. Treasury loses $50 billion every year. Well, last year, lost $50 billion. When someone itemizes their charitable contributions, the state reduces your tax burden and thereby does not collect the same amount of taxes from you that it wouldn't have otherwise collected had you not made the charitable contribution. So you might ask yourself the question, given the amount of redistribution that happens in American charity or philanthropy, would the state be able to do a better job with $50 billion in redistribution than American philanthropists do? That's an interesting empirical question to which there might be a concrete answer to get. And if you simply took the American Congress and its decisions about how it expends public tax dollars as a given, I submit to you that it is an open question whether Congress would be more redistributive than American charity is. Now, that's not an especially high bar, given how little redistribution is happening from American philanthropy. But if, as a political theorist, you arrogate to yourself the privilege of thinking that, well, if tax dollars were spent more justly, as I would like to do at least for a moment, then the $50 billion that we lose in tax revenue would be spent in a manner more consistent with redistributive aims. The second and final thing I'll conclude with. A relevant question for an economist or a social scientist in general to ask would be, does the existence of tax deductions shake out more charitable dollars from individuals than they would otherwise give without the incentive? What role does the incentive play in trying to get people to give money away? The initial studies on this question concluded that the incentive was quite important, and that in the absence of that incentive, if the state was providing no tax deduction for charitable giving, people would give away significantly less money. More recent studies suggest that those studies were overly confident in their estimation about how important the incentive is, and that the tax deductions don't act so much as an incentive to people to give money away, but rather as a reward for doing what people would do anyway. And that although if you eliminated the tax deduction for giving next year, prediction would be people would give away less money next year because they would not be trying to game a system in order to reduce their tax burden, and therefore they would give less money away. Over time, they would return back to their ordinary level of charitable giving. Now you might be thinking to yourself, why would that be? I want to give you two quick reasons to finish on this point. Ask yourself the question as a sociologist, as a psychologist, or just as an armchair citizen without the benefit of the disciplinary apparatus behind you, why do you make charitable contributions? Why does anyone make a charitable contribution? The answer to that question as a general matter is that people make charitable contributions and give money away. The best predictor is the following. Because someone you know asked you to make the charitable contribution. And it's difficult for you to let down your friend or colleague if they asked you to do so. The tax incentive would not eliminate that social dynamic. Why does Stanford provide a phone bank of undergraduates calling former alumni? Because they're aware of this social dynamic. They know that a phone call from someone with whom they have identification or affiliation is more likely to elicit from them a charitable contribution than would be a letter they got in the mail telling them about the beauty of Stanford, the wondrousness of Stanford. The personal touch is very, very important. A second reason, also very important, especially for those who give to religious organizations, is that you give because it's an obligation. You give because it's part of being a virtuous person. And the tax incentive might be nice, but in fact you might worry, it's actually corrupting my virtue. I now have to worry to myself, am I giving this money away because it's the right and good thing to do, or am I doing it to reduce my tax burden? It's harder for me to be virtuous now with the tax incentive. So, as a final statement, what I want to say to you is very little money from American charity goes to help the poor, and we could in fact claim $50 billion or something close to it by getting rid of the tax incentive without much change in how much money is actually given away. Now, you might think that the purpose of the tax incentives is not about efficiently producing a distribution of dollars to help the needy, but something else, something like enhancing pluralism or diversity. And I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ken Pruitt, perhaps to lay out a bit of that. Thanks.
Rob, I've been reading his stuff for a long time. I find it impressive. I'm sort of a fan of his research. Like him. So far as I know him, I can't imagine how he could have gotten this argument so wrong. So let me try to lay out a few reasons. Starting with the question, you know, should it be redistributive? I don't know, who said it should be? He said it, but the tax law doesn't say it. What the tax law says is that it has to be in the public good. The only way that you can get a tax subsidy for a charitable or a philanthropic contribution is it's got to be justified as being in the public good. Is there kind of anything in the public good other than redistribution? Like art? Music? Like a malaria vaccine? It's a very narrow conception of the public good to say that the public good is only about dealing with inequality. And indeed, this country and any country would be impoverished if it redefined the public good as simply restricted to that set of questions. Nothing wrong with redistribution. Poverty's an awful thing. So, by the way, is voicelessness, i.e., there are power asymmetries, there are economic asymmetries. And what you just heard is an argument that we should have less economic asymmetry. But I would argue that for a healthy democracy, we need a lot less power asymmetry. And therefore, if foundations go out and create voice for those people who do not have political voice, or feel like they don't have political voice, then I would make the argument that's healthy for our democracy. That has nothing to do with economic inequality. Indeed, the foundations that have been most successful in the last 25 years, 30 years, at giving political voice to a group that thought they did not have political voice were conservatives, who felt like, coming out of the Great Society legislation, that this country had brought heavily into a social welfare state, a regulated economy, and they were going to do something about it. And a very small number of foundations collected their energies and their little bits of monies, much, much smaller than the big so-called liberal foundations, and turned that into a systematic, intelligent, intellectually driven argument against the welfare state and the regulatory state. And we got from that the end of welfare as we know it, in Clinton's famous phrase. Now, you can say, I don't like the outcome of what those conservative foundations funded, but they gave voice through magazines, through books, through endowed chairs in universities, through conferences, through think tanks. They gave political voice to a group of Americans who thought they did not have political voice. Now, is that good or bad? Is that something we should not have allowed philanthropy to do? The problem with the premise, it seems to me, that Rob has started with, is that there is some system sitting outside of us, voters, participants in the political process, which is going to decide what part of the public good should philanthropy be focused on. That somehow a soup kitchen is better than an art museum. You can make that decision, but politically, we have not made that decision. And until we make that decision, then it seems to me you cannot say, just because you announce it, that a soup kitchen is a superior form of target for your philanthropy than is an art museum. And indeed, if all of the resources went to redistribution, why in the world wouldn't you have created a tax system in the first place that was more progressive? This country has got a problem, and I'll get to that in a second, in terms of the way in which it's constructed the relationship of the government to the private sector. Rob says, correctly, that most of American philanthropy is spent on ourselves. We are, after all, one of the richest countries in the world. Indeed, the bottom quintile in the United States on material measures is much, much better off than the top quintile in, say, Mali or Chad, by a wide margin. So if redistribution is the target, why in the world we spend any of our money on us? Why don't we go spend it in Mali or Chad, where poverty conditions are pretty desperate, as a matter of fact, or Myanmar today, et cetera, et cetera, on relief, earthquake victims, a lot of real, not poverty, but real suffering, human suffering going on today, of course, in both of those tragic natural occurrences. Okay, let's take earthquakes. Let's take the China earthquake. Thousands of deaths, thousands more injured, hungry, homeless, lost their families, et cetera, et cetera. This pick up American philanthropic money and spend it there. We'd feel better, right? Human suffering being relieved. What if I told you a month ago that the earthquake was going to hit in China, where it did, with the magnitude it was going to? And I said, here's the philanthropic money. How should we spend it? What would you tell me? Tell those people, tell those people and get them out of the path of the earthquake. I would think you would tell me that. Wouldn't that make sense to spend that money if you want to stop that suffering? What if I told you a year ago today that that earthquake may hit in China on that day in that place with that consequence? How would you want to spend it? You'd say, well, I think what we better do is get relief stuff in place. We can't relocate that many millions of people, but we can have Red Cross can be positioned, we can have relief systems ready to go, and so forth and so on. What if I told you 10 years ago there's a probability that we're going to have a big earthquake in that part of the world sometime the next 10 years and it's going to have this much consequence? How would you spend the money? What if I said at the same time, guess what? There's some people up at Berkeley working on plate tectonics. And if you really put that money into plate tectonics, you can discover the probability of an earthquake hitting in a particular part of the world at least 2 or 3 weeks before it hits. Now, Rob would say that if all of that philanthropic dollars went to plate tectonics research at wealthy research universities in the United States, it's not redistributive. But what if the breakthrough, the scientific, the intellectual breakthrough, was a system that allowed us to set up a serious early warning apparatus that could alert us to this, and so you can get people out of there, or you can get in the right kinds of relief services, or you can have building codes that would prevent, you know, a shoddy building of shoddy schools in China that's led to many of the deaths. What if instead we'd done advocacy work on building codes for schools around the world? Would that be a better use of the money? Part of the problem with the redistributive argument is the causal chain. At what point in the investment do you need to see the payoff, even if you want a redistributive payoff? Does it make sense to invest in a malaria vaccine? Now, I tell you who invests in a malaria vaccine, the U.S. military. Just in case we have to fight in the tropics again. By far, the most sophisticated research on malaria is done by the U.S. military, Walter Reed Hospital and so forth and so on, always has been. More recently, some of the other people interested in malaria vaccine are the tourist industry, for obvious reasons. When people go to the tropics, you don't want to get malaria. Malaria is coming up the coast. Therefore, we need a malaria vaccine. On the other hand, in that causal chain of investing in a malaria vaccine at first-rate departments of biology and research universities, down the road, some poor people, many poor people, are going to benefit because they have less capacity to resist the malaria than people who are better health, have better nutrition, and so forth. So there's a kind of a complicated causal chain. To follow the logic of Rob's argument out, you would have to sort of unpack what kind of investment had what sort of consequence for what kinds of people at what point now or later. There's one of the remarkable things about American Foundation Law, by the way. American foundations, the big ones, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Hewlett, Gates, Packard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They are all chartered into perpetuity. Perpetuity, that's a long time. But the fundamental law under which they allowed to come into being and get that tax benefit that Rob correctly pointed out is because they're going to be here doing good works into perpetuity. And the way that they're going to do that into perpetuity is they only have to spend 5% of their income. And if they got a decent investment, and many of them are making more than 5%, as a matter of fact, have over the last several years. 5% is the maximum they have to, or the minimum they are, the minimum they have to spend. If you think about that for a moment, the logic is that tomorrow's poor, even following the redistribution argument, tomorrow's poor are as important as today's poor. Indeed, the poor of any given generation or cohort or time period are as important as any other one because they're into perpetuity and they're spending 5%, which means if they're doing redistribution, if that is sticking just with that part of the argument, then you're presuming that today's problems are no worse or no better, no greater, no more challenging than tomorrow's problems. It's a very odd logic, by the way, that we've done in creating these foundations into perpetuity. The argument I would make is that if I wanted to really hang my hat on a redistribution argument, that's what it ought to be about, then I would argue to Rob and anybody else who wants to make that argument that they ought to be advocating for two things. One, getting rid of the tax subsidy altogether, Even if there's a slight dip in the amount of charitable giving, which I think over time there wouldn't be, you can only look when you're that wealthy. You can only buy so many yachts. At a certain point, you got that kind of money. You have to give some of it away. You're going to give so much of it to your kids. You can decide to bury yourself with it, like the King Tuts and so forth of the world. But that's, I don't know, a lot of people don't want to do that today. At least they don't seem to want to sort of put the cash down there with them. And so they're actually going to give it away and do something. And people like their names on things. 50 largest university foundations in the country. How many of them do not have the name of the donor in their title? One. Atlantic Philanthropies. The guy who did it, a very self-effacing guy, didn't want his name out there and so forth. Also, he did something else. He founded Atlantic Philanthropies with after-tax dollars. It's the only major foundation that was funded. Well, the early ones were funded without, because the tax law wasn't in place. But today, it's the only current contemporary foundation that was funded out of after-tax dollars. So that's an outlier. The other 49, it's Hewlett, it's Packard, it's Gates, it's Rockefeller, it's Carnegie, it's Packard, it's whatever. Fine. So they are getting something out of it, and that's part of the motivation. So I think they would give, even if it turns out they gave 65% of their wealth instead of 100% of, in other words, if they didn't get the tax relief, if they did with after-tax dollars, I think we would still have private foundations for different reasons, which I will get to in the concluding comment here. But the first thing I would say, if redistribution is your goal, get rid of the tax subsidy, and secondly, and especially if you can't get rid of the tax subsidy, sunset the foundations. That is, if you think, as I do, that the labor which created the asset base, which created the foundation, was underpaid, which is to say, whether it's the oil workers in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, that created the Rockefeller money, or the steel workers that created the Carnegie money, or the army of software engineers that created the Gates money, et cetera, et cetera. If you think that proportionate to the amount of money they created, the wealth they created, they were underpaid, then I would argue that you ought to be returning their labor investment, if not immediately to their generation, at least to their kids or their grandchildren. That somehow, if we sunset these foundations after, say, three generations, the labor that produced the wealth that got heavily concentrated in a very small number of hands, which is what great foundations, it's always enormous, the gap between how much money these, by definition, by the way, foundations are quote-unquote redistributive. Without these kind of numbers, by definition, I think Rob would agree, because whatever Gates gives his money to is to somebody poorer than he is. But that's true of all of, you know, I mean, none of these people don't live well, by the way, who created their foundations. Rockefeller lived well, Carnegie lived well, Mellon lived well, et cetera, Gates is living well, Hewlett's living well, blah, blah, blah. And so insofar as they're giving their money at all, even if it isn't going to the social service section, it is in that complicated way, or not so complicated way, redistributive. So I would say that a serious conversation about if you really want to create a different form of charitable philanthropic giving, that the way to do it would be some combination of no subsidy to the system at all, let people give because they want to give, and secondly, if you can't get away with that, at least don't let some particular institutions stay around into perpetuity. By the way, the foundation sector is growing at the rate of over 2% a year. That means it doubles every 13 years. It's an enormous growth sector because there's so much money coming along, you've got to park it someplace and so forth and so on. So let me conclude with this thought. And Rob, you know, correctly alluded to this, and as did as David in his introduction. This country, unlike almost any other country in at least contemporary country, has decided that the public sector is better than private sector is better than the public sector, for whatever the purpose is. And the idea that we will have foundations out there just in case we don't want to have a redistributive tax system, we want a regressive instead of a progressive tax system, we'll let the private foundations and charitable giving sort of clean up the messes. But that's true whether it's arts, whether it's education, whatever. This country doesn't like the public sector. It likes the private sector. It likes the old frontier mentality. I'm an individual. I want to make my private property. I want to make my wealth. I want to spend it how I want to, and so forth. Even public thinking is done in private institutions, paid for by public money, think tanks. That's where all the public policy thinking is going. That is, Rob's center here at Stanford is in a private institution being subsidized with taxpayer dollars to do public thinking about redistribution. And then to try to get the system to pay attention to it. It's one of the ironies, by the way, of think tanks is that most of their effort, including the conservative think tanks, most of their effort is trying to get the government to do something that it thinks it won't do unless they put pressure on it. But you don't do that inside the political process. You do that outside the political process. So we have created a system in this country where even thinking about public policy, public thinking about what kind of society we want to live in, is farmed out to a private sector and paid for with tax-subsidized monies. To make charitable giving also the responsibility of the private sector, and not all of us, not the collective society, not us representing ourselves through democratic processes, is, I would argue, is a dangerous place to be. And I actually do not think it's the most healthy democracy. I think a healthier democracy would be one in which we said that if we really don't want as much inequality as we have in this society, then we want a different kind of government with a different set of responsibilities, and not sort of let the loose ends be taken care of by charitable giving. It's not the kind of country that I believe we ought to live in. So my fundamental argument with the position that Rob has taken, it's kind of giving up, if you will, on the responsibility of the government, therefore the responsibility of all of us to create a different kind of society. And I don't know, our Gini coefficient is one of the highest of any of the developing countries. Pre-transfer, post-transfer, David says, maybe the highest in the world today. Ask yourself if that's the kind of country you want to live in. And if the answer to that is no, then hoping that charitable giving will make up for it is, my guess, a fool's errand. It's not going to get you there. By the way, with the exception of the conservative foundations, who went after a very particular part of the state, regulation and social welfare, and a more muscular foreign policy, they got all three of them, for better or for worse. No major foundation since the history of the private foundations starts up around the turn of the century, 19th century, into the 19th, early 20th century, has ever gone after the economic system that allowed the wealth to concentrate in the first place. They talk about going after root causes of inequality and of poverty, but root cause doesn't happen to include the kind of economic system that allows enormous concentrations in private hands. And because we allow those enormous concentrations of wealth in private hands, then we created this instrumentality called a foundation so they could find some place to put it and then put their name on it, and then hope they do things that are in the public good. So there's a host of reasons why I think coming into the inequality conversation via the responsibility of charitable giving and philanthropy is not going to get us there. And if that's where we want to be, the other point I want to make, have made, just repeat it, is that there are other things that apparatus, foundations, philanthropy, charity can do other than redistribution. And some of those other things are good public goods. We do not have a political process in this country that is willing to say that an art museum is less worthwhile than a soup kitchen. And if we want that kind of political process, then let's go ahead and create that kind of political process using advocacy money that will be paid for tax subsidies. But let's create that political process and go after it where it really will matter, which is not sort of in the charitable, not trying to write some sort of legislation that makes charities be more redistributive. Thanks.
I'll make three quick points to the very helpful remarks that Ken just offered, a good portion of which I don't necessarily disagree with at the end. But let me make three points. The first two concern the first sort of 10 minutes or so of Ken's comments. he was more or less accusing me of doing what philosophers or political philosophers are thought to do, namely attempting to be a philosopher king. Who made your values so important? Why you might think redistribution is the point of charity, but that's your opinion. It's nice to have an opinion. Good opinion, Rob, but this is a democracy where other opinions count, and the political process has apparently decided otherwise. So get off your philosophical king high horse and start being a Democrat. All right. Well, two responses to that, and then I'll save my third point for the last minute. There's an aspect of which I just fundamentally disagree with that accusation. And one aspect of that which I want to admit to or cop to. So how do I disagree? There is nothing in the presentation I gave to start off with that said the American state should interfere with the liberty of people to give money away to where they want to give it to. I did not attempt to say people ought to be giving money away to help the poor. What I suggested was that the tax incentives we have may not be appropriate if what we think we're doing is helping the poor because the distribution shows otherwise. All I tried to suggest at the end was that if we care about redistribution, just as Ken actually laid out in his own response, if what we care about is redistribution, then philanthropy or charity is not where we're going to get it, and we ought to get rid of the subsidy for giving money away. Give people the liberty to buy yachts, found foundations, build buildings, give it to their kids, or burn it. That's what it means to have a liberal democracy, to have liberty over your property. Don't subsidize them to exercise their liberty to give money away. So in that respect, I'm a complete Democrat, or liberal Democrat in that respect. I want to protect people's liberty. I don't want to subsidize their liberty to give it away to a puppet theater at the expense of other people who could use basic needs, or who need their basic needs being met. Which transitions into my second point, the place I disagree with the charge about being a philosopher king, or I should say I accept the charge of being a philosopher king. There are certain things in a society which ought not be left up to the democratic process. A constitutional democracy places limits on what majority electoral processes will yield. Whether or not citizens should have their basic needs met does not appear to be something that we ought to put up for democratic vote every once in a while to reaffirm that basic needs are important. So if that means making sure that the basic needs of people are met through the state rather than through charity, I would be happy to see that system arise. In fact, I might actually say that is a better system, in the way that Ken was alluding to himself, because we get some fundamental guarantees rather than leaving it to the vagaries and eccentric preferences and impulses of philanthropists, whom in some areas might wish to help the poor, but in other areas might not, or in some geographical areas might do so, and in other areas might not. To steal a nice line on this point from a fellow political philosopher named Will Kimlicka, he says that if a person votes against a politician who wants to expand the welfare state to meet the basic needs of citizens, votes against that politician, but privately gives money to a soup kitchen in order to meet basic needs, that person is a walking contradiction. Okay, last point, the thing that Ken was mentioning about, what about this weird causal chain of reasoning about what kinds of gifts actually do help the poor? What about the plate tectonic research at Berkeley and the gift that would self-support that? What about, to take one possible example, a philanthropic gift to the Center for Inequality here at Stanford? It's the mission in certain respects of the entire center to think about these questions, and I assume that David Grusman doesn't have an impartial view that inequality is just something to explore, it's something to reduce. Well, okay, this is a fair point, and I'll concede that the time horizon with which you make an expectation of redistribution matters. Do we need to have the redistribution happen within a week in order for there to be a tax subsidy that's justified? Do we need to have within a year or six months or a year? I'm not sure. These get to be complicated questions to answer empirically and theoretically for that matter. What's the appropriate time horizon? I'll only point out that as you introduce that argument, you start to go down a slippery slope. where you start to think almost anything can be justified in terms of redistribution if we just expand the time horizon long enough that maybe something good happens along the way downstream. So in the interim, let me suggest that the tax policies we now have just don't meet even that point. Why not set up some differential incentives? Let's allow people, even with incentives, to give money away to the Center for Inequality, or toward the plate tectonics research, or for that matter, to the soup kitchen or baldness research center. Let's give a greater incentive to people to give money away to the soup kitchen who's helping meet needs now, to the earthquake victims who need it today. We don't need to have a uniform, blunt instrument of incentives for every type of federal giving. Public policy can be creative and do otherwise. To think about the private giving to public school example, in Arizona, and I'll stop here, in Arizona, they have something interesting that just came online a couple years ago. I don't know the outcome of this, but at least it's creative thinking. You can make a charitable contribution with a tax credit, even more powerful incentive in Arizona, to a public school, so long as you do not give the money to your own kids' public school. Let's think creatively about our public policies in order to think about redistribution.
Anecdote. I spent about a decade as the senior vice president of the Rockefeller Foundation, which was doing agriculture research, population stuff around the world, global warming issues, and so forth and so on. And, you know, we sat around a table and had these intense arguments about whether this investment is better than that investment and so forth. Now, Rockefeller, the old man Rockefeller himself, is the guy who invented the idea of root causes, that what philanthropy should do is go after root causes. He said, I don't want to sort of give my money to a beggar on the street. I want to find out the root causes that create that condition in the first place and then get rid of them. And so he did public health, he did education, and so forth. So here we are, almost a century later, sitting around the table arguing intensely about these kinds of investments. And we invested in education, we invested in agricultural research, the Green Revolution after all, invested in public health and AIDS vaccine, invested in kind of, you know, plate tectonics, I mean, not quite, but close to that mechanism, that idea of kind of go back and sort of find some fundamentals, invest them and make them happen. Okay? Now, Rockefeller Foundation also had a personnel policy that they would match up to, I think it was $5,000, maybe $10,000 at the time, some number like that. They would match every employee's own charitable giving. So if I wanted to write a $500 check to something, they would match that so I get to take credit for a $1,000 gift. I once had the opportunity, because of the position I was in, to look at everybody's charitable giving for the year. Zero correlation between what the people did as individuals and what they insisted that they had to do as an institution. Zero. All of the individual giving got much closer to charity, to relief of suffering right now, to the neediest, because that's the kind of people they were, including myself. None of us ever used our matching gift to give a gift to one of the grantees that we had selected as officers. So I think there's a really complicated psychology that's going on here in terms of, from the point of view of public policy, what is the apparatus that's more likely to create what kinds of giving? And I can now no longer disagree with Rob. I think the idea of variable incentives for different kinds of giving is a very good public policy approach. My only concern about it is that I can't imagine the conversation that would get to it. If you're actually asking yourself about the United States Congress and is now going to have a discussion about which worthy cause is worth a zero incentive, a 10% incentive, a 20% incentive, and so forth and so on, just try to imagine the crafting of that public policy. It's not an accident that we don't have it, as a matter of fact. David mentioned that I study race relations and the official race classification. One of the things I've sort of stumbled across in doing that, the United States Congress has never had a debate about what is race in the United States. What are the racial categories? They just can't do it. It's too hot. So they let the bureaucracy sort it out under the radar screen. And I think this would be the same thing. So in principle, I think the idea of a variable incentive is very attractive. I think my instrument is blunter. No subsidy at all, plus sunsetting or some sort of combination of sunsetting and no incentive, because I think that's a more likely a possible public policy a response. But in principle, the idea that we, if the country could decide, I would put on the table the proposition, political scientists in the room can argue, not argue, that if the Congress were capable of actually having a conversation about a variable incentive thing, you could then, on the basis of the preferences of the United States Congress in terms of what was worthy and not so worthy, then you could then back up and create a tax system that actually do that, as against just doing away with a subsidy, which might be a healthier thing. So I'm sorry I called my friend Philosopher King, and I'm relieved that he's a liberal Democrat. It's small L or large L or whatever. I'm not trying to say what his partisan preferences are, but you know what his philosophical position is. And I do think that the importance of this debate or this discussion is that we do have a set of public policies that have created a certain kind of system. And I think personally that having university centers that debate and discuss the incentive structure that's been created and handed down from one generation to another without any kind of self-reflection is not a good thing. And I do not think the United States government has within it to have this conversation, which means it is going to fall back on it is going to be the role of the intellectuals, the social scientists, the universities, the research houses. Foundations themselves aren't going to lead this conversation. They like what they've got. And so it has to be some intellectual position outside of foundations to say, what is the right way to imagine structuring charitable giving, philanthropic giving in a society, especially society which is the highest Gini coefficient of inequality in any of the developing world. Thanks.
Developed.
Okay, now we want to turn to questions from all of us. So why don't both of you come up and just fire away with the questions, just to make sure to specify to whom you're addressing, either one of them or both.
No, that's a fine answer. Good.
Yeah. This is actually for Professor Pruitt. You said that breakthroughs are very important as pop- public goods. And you also mentioned that the past, the present and the future are to be equal. So if we follow your argument, we could actually say that redistribution in education is necessary, because if we say that today's researchers are as important as tomorrow's, we have to treat all researchers the same, including the potential ones, and we have to ensure that potential researchers who are born poor actually have the opportunity to become real researchers. Therefore, because you don't know that abilities will be correlated with wealth, therefore, at least in education, you need to have redistribution if you want to treat the future researchers, the creators of breakthroughs, at the same level as today's researchers.
Yeah, let me just very quickly say, I said the way the tax law is written, it creates this into perpetuity. There, tomorrow's poor, tomorrow's whatever are as important as today's. That's just the way the tax law is written. I actually, my own position would be, because I believe we ought to sunset foundations after a while. It tries to get the cohort, the population that created the wealth ought to be the population, or at least its kids or grandchildren, who ought to benefit from that wealth. There's going to be new wealth created on down the road and so forth. Your point, your other point, though, is really quite interesting. At what point do you want an intellectual breakthrough in against anything? I mean, I think this country vastly underinvested in global warming back when we should have been doing it in the 1910 and 20s, when we already had hints about it, not even in the 1950s. And no foundations did any kind of serious research at that time. Neither did the federal government. Nobody did. Now, if we were smart enough to know that this is a problem. Now, pandemics, we already knew in 1920, after the great flu pandemic, we knew there were going to be new pandemics. We were surprised by AIDS, of course. We didn't know what it was going to be. We at least knew what pandemics were, and therefore we created a public health system. It's a pretty flawed one, a pretty fragile one. It doesn't work well in developing countries and so forth. But nevertheless, we had the wit to kind of create something for you. Should we have, at that moment, in the 1920s, spent more money on a public health system, not just here but around the world? I would have said yes. Because we knew pandemics were going to happen. When we knew the population bomb hit, 1950s or 60s, we knew we saw this surge. A lot of foundation money went into that. I wish that we had spent more money in that moment, not just 5%, but more money in that moment. So I can, it's like my accusation of Rob, that you tell me the political process would lead to that. Well, he can certainly say that now about what I'm about to say. But nevertheless, this is the moment in which we live. This is the moment in which great wealth is being created. And I would love it if there were a process that said, let's find the big things that are going to face the world over the next 25, 50 years. Energy independence is an obvious one now. But there are others that I could. Invasive species. We've spent very little research money on invasive species. It's really become a serious problem because of all the movement and so forth and so on, and pandemics and so forth and so on. So I can imagine 5% is a pretty meager way to go after the magnitude of the problems. And then down the road, more people are going to be better off if we make a bigger investment today. I also think new wealth is going to get created, new foundations are going to get created, so good. Let Gates spend his money out over the next 10 or 15 years. So yes, that's a very interesting point. When do you want the ideas to hit? David seems.
Can I just follow up on that?
Oh, yeah,
because
sure.
It seems like your sunsetting provision would presume, if I follow up the logic of what you just said, would presume that you think the problems that are spun out at any given moment are roughly equivalent to the wealth generation that occurs in that moment in history. And what would make one believe that, that the problems are proportionate to wealth?
Sure. I mean, you're right.
Maybe so.
Yeah. But I didn't say much about the sunset thing. I did not say sunset the foundation sector. I said sunset a foundation. If you don't sunset foundations, individual foundations, this sector is going to grow like that. At whatever rate you're going to have wealth creation, the sector is going to grow, I say, 2% a year. There are some 80,000 foundations in the United States today. Now, not all of them give a lot of money. The big ones, but you got the Buffett, you got the Gates, all in the last 10 years, or 15, 20 years, the Gates, the Beckers. I just don't want the sector, it goes back to my argument about we demean the state. We have a low taste in this society for politics. And I simply don't want a sector out there that's got so much money. Gates has got enough money now to outspend WHO. And if he decides what the world needs with respect to public health. He can now make that happen. And WHO will be sitting in the corner. Fine. But who elected Bill Gates to decide what public health was? That this disease was more important than that disease. So that's what I worry about. That's why I say a given foundation, not the sector, not the enterprise itself, I wouldn't sunset. Yes, no, exactly. It's
to get your opinion.
Yes.
It's actually a growing movement. Most of
yes.
the smaller and family foundations
yeah.
to spend now.
Yeah.
But,
no. Including Gates is talking about it, by the way.
Right.
Yes.
Thanks for
yes.
So the
yes.
other question I had was for you, and it's more about, it sounds almost like a semantic distinction, but I really think there's a big difference between philanthropy and charity. And you kind of conflate the terms, and I wanted to get your opinion on that because a lot of people do consider philanthropy to be more getting at the root cause and more about systemic change. Charity is more about the things that you said might create the different tax incentives. Excuse me, no more for like the Burmese cyclone or the China earthquake. It's a more immediate relief.
Yeah, right. You're absolutely right to pick up on the fact that for those who are within the nonprofit sector or within the foundation sector, the meaning of philanthropy is about root causes, maybe charity is about direct aid right here and now. The reason I conflated the two is that more or less public policy conflates the two. The public policies that treat charitable giving don't distinguish all that in any meaningful way between a gift that is meant for charitable purposes and a gift that is meant for philanthropic purposes. Now, there are separate provisions set up for foundations, and Ken was getting at that, but in terms of the original gift the foundation has set it up, that's treated as a charitable gift. Or a philanthropic gift, depending on how you want to call it, but it's an identical form of treatment. So maybe you would like to say, following up your suggestion, that we ought to have public policies that allocate or afford different types of incentives for philanthropic gifts giving at root causes and charitable gifts doing direct aid. But that's just to restate my point before about having some creativity in our public policy to do incentives in a different way rather than this uniform blunt instrument.
Right. It just seems like there's a lot more nuance within the philanthropic sector than. Maybe some of this argument lends itself to, like public foundations, for example, can re-grant to C4 foundations or organizations, which we don't really talk about in lobbying and all of that. So
right, and private foundations, the community foundations, all of these have some nuanced differences among them, and so there is some differential treatment. You're right about that. All that would take us into a sophisticated discussion for insiders, which I didn't presume for this audience, but be happy to follow it up if you.
I was kind of surprised at the sort of general tone that the government would be a better allocator and provider of needs and research and things like that. I mean, I don't know if you guys are going to different DMV offices than I am or looking at different reports of what airplanes the Pentagon is buying. I've yet to see one single thing, and it's like, maybe Bill Gates is going to be more towards, you know, curing diseases that only occur in the tropics because of his interest in Africa versus what some people in Iceland are suffering from. But it's like he earned that money, you know? I mean, why should a government come in and say, no, we really want to work on something else? I mean, the government is an inefficient allocator. I mean, why is that?
That's a familiar, by the way, argument in the literature. About defending philanthropy, if foundations in particular, not charity, but that because the foundations can be more efficient. It's in my judgment, I've actually written about this, it's an odd argument because it's the only major actor that has zero accountability on efficiency grounds. If the government messes up, in principle, you can throw them out and find a new group. We have elections. If a market actor messes up, you can bankrupt them. You can stop buying their product. And indeed, the great swirl of the market economy is you keep turning over institutions as some get inefficient and can't keep up anymore. They're selling the wrong stuff. They're horse buggy whips instead of automobile horns or what have you. But the private, once you give this money to a foundation to perpetuity, as long as it spends its 5%. And as long as it matches very, very elementary things, like a public report at the end of the year about how it's transparency issues, But there's nothing in the tax code that says soup kitchens instead of art museums, or tropical medicine instead of Icelandic medicine or whatever. There's nothing in the tax code that says that. So I'm not trying to make I absolutely think that in a democracy we should not turn everything over to the private sector. Some things ought to be in the public sector, and we ought to regulate that by voting as best we can. Nothing's fool safe.
Let me offer a quick response to that too. I mean, I just suggest two things. You suspect that given what we've said, Ken and I are big sort of social democrats, maybe even
socialists.
Right,
yeah.
There you go. Maybe even socialists. Big state, take care of us all. I want to resist that charge for the moment and then return the implication to you in a certain way. Not that your comment reflects any socialist bias, but your comment reflects an anti-democratic bias. You like what Bill Gates does? Maybe he's more efficient at what he's doing. Forget about democracy. Let's just have some rich guys with their values take care of us and do things because they're more efficient. We don't need democracy. We need plutocracy. Those are the smart people. So I want to know, where's the democratic forum, even if it's inefficient? Aren't there important benefits, even accepting massive inefficiency, to having transparency, accountability, elections, the in principle permission for every person to have an equal voice in the process? So that's the first worry. The second point I want to make is that, and I think this complements actually something Ken said before, which is that by allowing private charity, private philanthropy, to fulfill things that are basic needs, we actually delay the day when we might act as Democrats or as citizens. So go back to that table I showed you of private giving to public schools in Woodside. The head of the Woodside School Foundation was quoted in the newspaper as saying something like the following. His last name was Drager, which made me think he's connected to the Drager grocery store chain. I don't know that to be true.
He is.
Who you know? Okay. The quote was, I entirely agree with this quote. I think he's absolutely right. He said the following. We need to have these foundations because we need private donations to do what the state isn't doing. If the state were funding our schools, we could close down our shop. Which I think, right. So essentially the people in Woodside believe that the state should be doing more, but because now they give privately, they don't need to go up to Sacramento to argue. They've got what they want. So they actually diminish the incentive they would have to participate as citizens, and they're probably the most savvy, influential people who might succeed in Sacramento.
Yeah. See, that's the deep irony and worrisome irony about all this. You take pressure off of the government because. Go ahead.
I'd like to shift the discussion a bit to basic needs. It has always seemed to me that philanthropy was sort of like a macro version of what I would call the Thanksgiving dinner syndrome. Mm-hmm. That is, every year about Thanksgiving time, people are encouraged to give a meal, maybe serve a meal, to homeless people who are scavenging garbage the rest of the year. They feel good about that. They've done something that makes other people feel good. They can tell their friends about it. And yet, for 364 other days, that person's not eating. So if your concern is just simply to meet basic needs, right? Food, shelter, health, if that's your concern, then how can you get government to meet that without the kind of, I would say, crippling welfare system that we used to have? What would you recommend?
Another hour and a half. At a minimum. No, it's the fair question. Do you want to take a shot at it and then go ahead?
What would we need to have the state be capable of meeting the basic needs of people so that we didn't have charity only one day of the year? Did I get it right?
Well, the Victorian charitable impulse was what created foundations in part. Rockefeller was very self-conscious about, I'm going to break free of this kind of the Thanksgiving feed a person for a day. I want to feed them for 365 days. I'm going to do that with public health system. I'm going to do that with education system. I'm going to do that with agricultural research. The Green Revolution that came out of the Rockefeller Foundation was vilified I'm sure Rob would not have been part of this had he been around at that point. But it was vilified because wealthier farmers in India made more money than poor farmers. On the other hand, the Green Revolution made India self-sufficient in food. That's for everybody up and down the economic chain. So it's very complicated, this redistribution argument is the point. But Rockefeller very much wanted to break free of the Thanksgiving basket. Rockefeller actually wanted it in the private sector, not in the government.
He wanted to break free of that problem with the single major exception that he didn't want to attack the economic system that
right.
made him really
right.
rich and
right.
it makes Gates obscenely rich.
Right.
And so if we've got a frontier ethic and the American politics is directed in that way, favoring private over public, then we're not going to have the kind of government services that many, many other developed
yeah.
countries have.
Yeah.
So I'm asking...
Yeah. Yeah. The other answer to you, is not we need an hour and a half. The simplest thing is get on a plane, go live in Sweden. You know. Yeah. Which
tax rate 80%.
But see, wait a minute. It starts on the premise that money is something that the individual creates, not that the social system creates. The social system of infrastructure, the social system of monetary policy, and so forth. Your comment starts on the assumption that money we made is money that we would have made if there were no state at all. That's just bogus. Yeah.
The one here, and I know David wants to end, but it's apt. Warren Buffett is said to have said that... put this boy in India or Malawi and see what he would have made. The implication being that the social structure in which he existed contributed 90% of his wealth, and that if he had been born accidentally in some other place, he would have been a poor person just like everybody else.
I want to thank both of our speakers for an extraordinary performance.